Session number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 22.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 22.
Having left Singapore on the 16th of September 1946 on Her Majesty's Troop Ship Britannic, we crossed the Indian Ocean into the Arabian Sea, took on water again at Steamer Point Aden, then up the Red Sea to the Suez Canal. The artillery units, low-level air defence, or ACAC, light ACAC as they were called in World War II, had all gone that we'd seen on the way out in September of 1943. And we stopped again in Portside to take on water. There I put in an application to join the airborne forces and carry out parachute training on my return to the United Kingdom. Major Dixie Dean gave me the address of the airborne establishments to write to at Salisbury, and I posted that in the service mail at Port Said, knowing that it would be actioned by the time I got back to the UK 2 weeks later.
What made you make that decision, take that decision?
Because I appreciated the value of airborne forces in getting onto the other side of the hill, in the enemy's rear. Airborne forces, whether by parachute or glider, is specifically a means of transport. And if you can transport infantry and get them behind the enemy without having to, while other units are slogging away at the front, then it throws them off balance. And of course today we have the air mobile helicopter borne units carrying out the same principle of war. As we left Port Said early one morning, I watched the dhows and the masts at the distance, and Major Biddulph Pinchard, who I'd known in Seremban with the Civil Affairs, a pre-war Malay planter, stood nostalgically looking at the masts of the dhows and the sails in Port Said Harbour, and he turned and said, with a pang of regret, no doubt, "The gateway to the east, probably for the last time." We then sailed on through the Med and past Gibraltar. It was again a 6 or 7 day voyage through the Mediterranean. And shortly after passing Gib, one evening, there appeared to be a queue to get into one of the bathrooms to have a freshen up before the evening meal. This particular evening, most of the bathrooms seemed to be in great demand, and there were about three chaps in front of me in the particular bathroom I'd hoped to go into. So I returned to my cabin. Suddenly, I heard shouting and excitement, and a chap ran past the cabin door, which was actually a curtain, with a cutthroat razor. So I looked out, thinking that there was some form of razor fight going on. What had happened? The two or three chaps waiting to get into this bathroom had knocked on the door half an hour, 20 minutes previously, and asked the chap to hurry up, and he'd replied, "All night, all right." But the next time they knocked, there was no reply, and they wondered what on earth was happening, knocked the door open, and found him hanging from a rope tied round one of the water pipes. The chap with the cutthroat razor cut him down. They were holding him by the hips and legs, so his head was on the floor. I got hold of him by the hair, lifted his head up, and then got my arms under his shoulder, backed out, and we got him into the cabin opposite ours. The difficulty then was to get the rope, which had gone, being a thin clothesline type of rope, had got well into his neck. Eventually this was cut loose, but despite artificial respiration, the chap had sadly died. We learnt later that he was an inspector, or chief inspector, from the Malayan police, who had been interned by the Japanese during their occupation of Malaya, had been repatriated after the Japanese surrender, gone back to Malaya and had a nervous breakdown. What was even more sad was the fact that his wife, pregnant wife, was on the boat at the same time, but in the female quarters. The unfortunate fellow was buried at sea. We then sailed on, the weather getting somewhat colder, nippier, and eventually on or about the 7th of October, we got into Liverpool Harbour. We disembarked and got our kit, went through customs, and then got on a train, myself heading for Newcastle. It was evening, and I asked the guard if I could kip in the guard's van, which he readily agreed to do, and I had a good kip, waking up in Newcastle following morning, and transport took me and two or three others to Fenham Barracks. I rang my brother, my second brother, and asked if he would come and pick me up, and I could tell by his voice there was a marked reluctance. So within a year of the war ending, the chaps who'd done this stuff in the Royal Navy, the Army and the Air Force were beginning to take a back seat. So in addition to the colder weather, I could sense a colder atmosphere. I was then put on the posted strength of No. 6 Infantry Holding Battalion. On my reaching my mother's home, Greenbank, Middle Harrington, I found mother not too well and ill in bed, but as I said earlier on the previous tape, she put me on the track of the Bosanquet family at Rock Annick, which I did straight away the first morning back. I then also found the application forms for apply for airborne forces. These I completed and got them off straight away. So within a fortnight, I was called to go back to Hartford Bridge, No. 6 Infantry Holding Battalion near Morpeth, get a rail warrant to go on a 3-day parachute officer selection board, known as a POSB, at the regular commissions board at Coleman's Hatch, Haywards Heath in Sussex. I went by train from Newcastle to King's Cross, London, and in the compartment were an oldest gentleman with his wife, and we got on talking, and I found that he in fact was Frank Cooper of the celebrated Oxford Marmalade family, and I was wearing my Durham Light Infantry service dress, and Mrs. Cooper sadly told me that one of their sons had been killed with the Oxford and Bucks Light Infantry in Normandy, and she got out a very nice photograph of their late son to show me, and one could honestly say that there was a typical light infantry officer along with his soldiers and many, many others in the different theatres of war, the flower of our country who'd made the supreme sacrifice. I stayed overnight at the officers' club in South Audley Street, London, and the following morning at breakfast, I was just about to leave to get the train from London down to Haywards Heath when there was a shout, "William!" And there was an old school friend, George Hineson, who'd gone from Durham School to do medicine and then was commissioned as a medical officer in the Royal Air Force after the war. So we had a quick chat and then I was on my way down to Haywards Heath. Transport picked me up, and on the way I saw bomb damage and was told that some of it had been caused by a flying bomb. It's my first experience of the flying bombs, although the damage was over a year old, well over a year, 18 months old, in late 44 or early 45 before the German surrender. The three-day selection board, one was put through various tests, mental and physical. I knew that I would, being very, very confident, would sail through it, just as I'd sailed through the regular commission selection board at Changi earlier in 1946. And the specialist member on the selection board from the parachute regiment was Colonel Peter Luard of the Oxford and Bucks Light Infantry, and a famous commander of the 13th Parachute Battalion in Europe. And he took them on to Malaya. Colonel Peter at that time was back in the UK. The psychiatrist that interviewed me, the only comment he made was that my writing was bold handwriting. Whether that indicates one's character or not, I don't know. Because in Burma, I was certainly as frightened as the next man, if not more so. I didn't disclose to my mother that I was planning to go to the parachute regiment. But having passed the board, I was then, at the end of my 28 days leave, called back to the 6th Infantry Holding Battalion to get a rail warrant for Aldershot. I spent one night there and then got the train to report to the Airborne Forces Depot at Aldershot, made a barracks, on or about the 16th of November for the 2 weeks pre-parachute training in the famous P Company. During my leave, I looked up various people that I'd known from school days, including two school friends, Cass and Colin Craven, who'd moved from Stanley County Durham to Whitley Bay. As I mentioned in an earlier interview, their elder sister, Louise Craven, had very kindly sent me a tin of cigarettes, which arrived from Stanley into the middle of Burma, and I was able to, being a non-smoker, dish them out to my platoon. So I was able to return that kindness by taking her out for tea at a restaurant in Newcastle, and eventually on one occasion to Tilly's. When we were having tea, there were two ladies sitting at an opposite table who insisted on paying for our tea. And it was quite obvious to me that they were from Jewish families, and that in some way they must have appreciated what the chaps had done during the war. It's very probable that they had relatives themselves in the armed forces. But I was very impressed by this small act of kindness, which to me was a very big kindness.
Was there much of it evident at this time that, or were people rapidly forgetting war and what people had done for them in the war? Or was this just a feeling you were getting?
Only certain individuals. And as I said earlier, I could sense it also within my own family. My eldest brother, in particular, was particularly jealous of the fact that he'd stayed at home, wining and dining and boozing and working in fits and starts, and even having to be conscripted for the Home Guard, that I had done my stuff, along with many others from Middle Harrington and East Harrington villages, Sunderland and County Durham, the whole country. But we were the lads that had done it, and we were the lads that tended to mix with one another. The other people that hadn't gone and done their stuff were, to use the expression, outside the pale. I thoroughly enjoyed my leave. I looked up another young lady at Clieden who I'd known from school days, Greta Drummond, who was then a medical student. But I formed a very close friendship with Miss Margaret Louise Craven. who had been kind to me and written throughout my period overseas, from Bangalore through to Malaya. Although, naturally, while we were away, they had their own boyfriends at college and university. At the end of my leave, I went down and reported to the Maida Barracks for the pre-parachute training.
What date is this, Colonel?
On about the 16th of November 1946. There were about a dozen of us officers on the course, and of course probably over 100 soldiers. And we were all from British battalions, some of whom had been abroad, either in the desert, Italy, or occupation in Germany and Austria, and I was the only one from the Far East. A lot of the work was done in the famous Maida Gymnasium under the command of Company Sergeant Major Instructor Baxter, and my own particular platoon was commanded by a very experienced Middle East warrior from the Army Physical Training Corps who'd been with the 5th Parachute Battalion in the Middle East, in Greece and elsewhere. Company Sergeant Major Instructor Harrington, Quartermaster Sergeant Instructor Barrows, was another instructor there, and Quartermaster Sergeant Instructor Evans, the Army Bayonet Fighting Champion. They were very, very the cream of the Army Physical Training Corps. In addition, of course, to a lot of work in the gymnasium on the apparatus, we did a lot of route marching and running. The airborne armour at that time was provided by the 3rd Hussars, and when we did the long distance bash, which was some 10 or 15 miles, whatever, I realised that one of the 3rd Hussars troopers wasn't going to make it, so I pushed him the last quarter of a mile. He tried to fight me off, saying that I would fail as well, but I knew that if I kept pushing him, he'd get through, and we crossed the line just beyond the Aldershot Officers Club. But a good spirit of comradeship existed. We then moved from Aldershot to the Royal Air Force Station at Upper Heyford in Oxfordshire, near Bicester. The soldiers stayed at the Parachute Corps Administrative Unit at Middleton Stoney Camp, about 2 miles down the road. We officers were in a wooden hut at the rear of the officers' mess, but we did eat within the mess. We then commenced 1 week's synthetic training, when we practiced rolls on the PT mats within the hangar within the subunit within RAF Station Upper Heyford, Number 1 Army Parachute Training School. Number 1 APTS at this time was commanded by Wing Commander Jimmy Shield, also from Stanley County, Durham, and as a school teacher, he'd been a contemporary of Louise Craven's father, Norman Craven. The second in command was Squadron Leader Jimmy Blythe, who again was a pre-war science teacher with a degree in Bachelor of Science. And Jimmy Blythe had been one of the first parachute jumping instructors when the parachute school first opened in 1940 at RAF Ringway, Manchester, and the dropping zone at Tatton Park. Jimmy Shield had been one of the first instructors to open up the parachute training school in India at Chaklala near Rawalpindi. The syndicate we were in, the syndicate flight sergeant, was Flight Sergeant Alf Card, later to be awarded the Air Force Medal and Bar, and I'm pleased to say that I'm still in touch with Alf Card. Later, one of his claims to fame was breaking a leg on the Salt Lake dropping zone at Akrotiri on either his 1,001st jump or thereabout, certainly just over the 1,000 mark. So it proved the point that accidents can happen to anybody. In more recent years, probably some 8 or 9 years ago, when I was in Stanley, I checked at the newsagent's shop, which had been owned by the Shield family, as to whether Tommy Shield was still alive. I'm correcting that. I called him Jimmy earlier, but it was Tommy Shield. But he had gone to the great parachute school in the sky. The syndicate officer was Flight Lieutenant Bill Paul, who had just been newly commissioned. Bill later became secretary of the British Parachute Association. And sadly, too, Bill is no longer with us. Jimmy Blythe and I both attended the Airborne Forces Golden Jubilee dinner at the London Guildhall in February of this year, 1990, and regrettably, owing to the heaving throng of some 800 of us, I didn't get the chance to speak to Jimmy or Jerry Turnbull, who was a flight lieutenant at the school at the same time. But within a week, I sadly saw Jimmy's death reported in the Daily Telegraph. I got the present officer commanding No. 1 Army Parachute School at RAF Bryars Norton, Wing Commander Pete Watson, to represent Alf Card and I at Jimmy Blythe's funeral. In addition to rolling and learning forward left, forward right, side left and side right, rear left, rear right rolls, we also jumped from the fan, from the hangar roof, where one puts a very small, more pram-like harness on as opposed to a parachute harness, and it's an exit trainer, and you do the normal exit. And one wonders whether it will even hold you, but of course it does. And the wire rope is attached to a roller, and the fan blades led you down more or less at the speed of a parachute descent. And we also did parachute drills within and from mock fuselages within the hangar. It was a very severe winter, the beginnings of a very severe winter, in the December of 1946, when we were at Upper Heyford. My colleagues, Ray Marshall was from the Queen's Royal Regiment, Jerry Mott from the Loyal Regiment, and Alan Munro from the Border Regiment, now the King's Own Royal Border Regiment. Alan and I are still in contact.
Was the training tougher than light infantry training, more endurance tests, this kind of thing?
The training at Aldershot was tough for some people, but many of us, as I said earlier, had served either in the desert Italy or Europe or the Far East, and I found it a piece of cake. We lived under somewhat Spartan conditions in above the Airborne Museum, which was in the old Corunna Mess. The Airborne Museum at that time was in the ground floor, and we lived in rooms in the upstairs. Bare boards, just a bed with blankets and pillows, and enough room to store our kit. A batman brought us warm water to wash and shave in tin bowls, metal bowls in the morning, and we had an excellent batman in our room from the 1st Parachute Battalion, Paddy Maguire, who originally had been with the Royal Ulster Rifles. The Royal Ulster Rifles was a glider-borne battalion, and Paddy had transferred as soon as possible because of the high-ish casualty rate among glider-borne battalions. And he put it into the words of the Irish, "I don't mind parachuting, sir, but fuck this fucking gliding," was the words of that Paddy scored on my memory. A very good character indeed, one of the typical Irish soldiers of the old school. But to me, P Company was a piece of cake. I'm not saying that I didn't sweat and have to pull a certain amount of throttle on, but having been through jungle training, it was a doddle. And
was part
also
of your
been through the 14th Army.
Was part of your training dealing with the experiences of parachute warfare previous?
No, there's no such thing as parachute warfare. It's infantry warfare, having been transported by parachute. The weakness is that the heavy weapons have to be dropped as well, and when one drops from an aircraft, one is dispersed because of the speed of the aircraft going, and one has to have a rendezvous But once you're down on the ground, you're on your plates of mutton, and it is infantry warfare, but with a lighter scale of weapons, although we did have a 3-inch mortar platoon in each battalion. But until the airborne artillery is down, and they drop on invariably on a separate dropping zone, you're without the weapons of the light field artillery. And, of course, glider-borne and the Hamilcar gliders of World War II, and they were still in vogue at the time, the Hamilcar carried light armoured cars such as the Dingo Scout car for the 3rd Hussars. So we bashed on our first week of synthetic training in the hangar with the mock-ups and on the trapezes, learning harness release drills and all parachute drills within the hangar. And the day came when we would do our first parachute descent from a balloon. And the program consisted of, in the time at the parachute training school, two balloon descents followed by six aircraft descents, one of which would be at night. We trucked down to the parachute dropping zone at Weston-on-the-Green, which is still in use to this day. The school later moved to RAF Abingdon and is now at RAF Bryce Norton, but Middleton Stoney Village and the parachute DZ are still there, and the DZ in use today. We watched our colleagues going up five at a time with an instructor and jumping, and then our stick's turn came. Our stick had been trained for that week by two corporals, Corporal Jameson and Corporal Basil Hall. Jameson was dispatching for our first descent, and we were given stick order, and he said, "I know you'll go, sir, so you're last man, number five. Evidently, it's the worst position." I watched my colleagues go, particularly one chap looking, because of his fair hair and fresh red skin, Jenkins, a very good South Welshman, going, and then away he went. Jameson pulled the bag in, and I thought, I wonder where the bloody hell's he gone? Well, I knew where he'd gone whistling down on his first descent. When the four had gone, my turn came. Red on, stand at the door. Green on, go. Out I went. For a split second I thought, that bloody thing's not going to open, and suddenly it was there. I adopted a parachuting position, assessed my line of drift, and did a normal landing. I landed next to another colleague on the course, Lieutenant Jeff Sneesham, who exclaimed, "Well, here's old William Waitman." And we rolled our chutes up together. Jeff had been with the Devonshires in one of the glider battalions in 6th Airborne Div in Normandy, and was an experienced airborne warrior.
What's a parachute position?
The parachute position is the position you adopt when you're floating down between the aircraft of the balloon and the ground, and you assess your line of drift. If you're drifting forwards, you get onto your rear lift webs, and if you're drifting backwards, you get onto the front lift webs. And when you're about 50 to 80 feet from the ground, you pull down on the lift webs, and that to some extent slows your rate of descent. And for landing, you adopt a good position with the feet and legs together, back under the body, your chin on your chest, and your elbows in, and land accordingly. Sometimes you have assessed your line of drift correctly, and other times you haven't, and if you get away with it, all well and good. It's the ones you walk away from that count. That was our first descent, and as it was a large course, there wasn't time to get the second one in that day, so we then went back to Upper Hayford. The Christmas break was then next on the agenda, and we were given 4 or 5 days Christmas leave. I remember walking through the snow with my colleagues of all ranks to Upper Hayford railway station, and then eventually getting on the line through the Midlands, Derby. I remember passing the power station at Ferry Bridge, heading for Newcastle. And on the train was an RAF chap, Ronnie Nesbitt, who had been a village boy along with me prior to our both joining the forces. So we had quite a bit to talk about, he in the RAF, myself in the army. During the Christmas break, prior to going on the break, we had had to be detailed for duty officer over the Christmas period. And true to form, I drew the short straw and was to be duty officer Christmas Eve. So our course commander, an already qualified parachute regiment officer, Lieutenant Owen, we asked if the permanent staff, who were actually in married quarters on the station, Major Clark and his adjutant, would stand in for us. But we were all marched in front of Major Clark, who told us that if anyone objected to doing orderly officer over Christmas, he'd be sent back to Aldershot, kicked off the course. As we'd only done the one descent, we didn't wish to be chucked off the course in case people thought we'd refuse to jump. Anyone who refused to jump was known as a jibber.